Irish Illustrated Insider subscribers. This is Drew Mentock, and I'm here to bring you the seventh episode from our bi-weekly podcast series on the feed, Irish Illustrated Interviews. Today, we're sharing my conversation with offensive lineman Aaron Taylor, a 2021 College Football Hall of Fame inductee, Super Bowl champion, and Notre Dame legend. He played for the Fighting Irish from 1990 to 1993, becoming a consensus and unanimous All-American in his final two seasons, and winning the 1993 Lombardi Award. In 1994, the Green Bay Packers selected him with the 16th overall pick in the first round. 3 years later, he started in Super Bowl 31, with the Packers defeating the New England Patriots 35-21. He later signed and played for the San Diego Chargers in 1998, but injuries forced him to retire a year later. Our conversation spans his entire playing career and more. Plus, we dive into his tenure as an analyst, first with ABC Sports and then now at CBS Sports Network, where he currently covers college football. Lastly, we delve into his role in creating and administering the Joe Moore Award, named after Notre Dame's legendary offensive line coach. Here's my interview with Aaron. Everyone, I'm here with Aaron Taylor today. He, as many know, played at Notre Dame from 1990 to 1994. He was a two-time All-American. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame. He's a Lombardi winner. He's a first-round NFL draft pick. Today, he's a college football analyst at CBS Sports. Has obviously done a lot in with the game, and we'll get into all that. But first, I wanted to kind of start. I know you grew up a kid from Northern California, not necessarily close to South Bend, Indiana. What's your first like kind of recollection or association with Notre Dame?
Well, the first time I ever even heard Notre Dame and figured out that it wasn't this church in England, which I later learned was in France, was from my athletic director, Tom Bowen at De La Salle, who happened to be a Notre Dame grad. He was in the seminary at Notre Dame, met a girl at St. Mary's, decided that the seminary wasn't for him, but went on to graduate and was a huge lover of the school, obviously, and drank the blue and gold Kool-Aid as we all are apt to do. And when I started getting recruited, he just said, man, you got to take a trip. You got to take a trip. You got to take a trip. And in those days, there was like one big recruiting weekend, and it typically was during the football banquet. I believe it was December 2nd, 1989. And Regis Philbin was the host that day. You know, they had just come off a national championship a couple years prior. And what I remembered about it was, one, how cold it was. Two, was how good the people were. And I think we ended up signing 21 or 22 of the 26 guys that were on that trip. I think Jerome Bettis and maybe even Bryant Young were on another trip, or maybe it was Oliver Gibson. I can't remember, but most of us were there and we just vibed and clicked right away. And it started off with a bang, man. It felt really good from the beginning.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about that. I think now maybe we're starting to see Notre Dame get more back to that talent level, but I think that's still regarded as maybe one of the best recruiting classes, at least in the more modern era. You mentioned Jerome Bettis, Bryant Young, Tom Carter was also on that team.
Yeah.
Jeff Burris, like you had five first round picks, a bunch of, you know, high school All-Americans. Like, what was it like to kind of come in with so many other talented players?
I think it was like, it's interesting, man. Like, I don't know if we know how good we were. We got recruited. Like, I was on the first USA Today All-American team. Oliver Gibson was the defensive player of the year. And we also had Tim Ruddy, I think, was the first or second pick and, you know, of the draft his year, and had a 10-year career being the center for Marino at Miami. But, man, we had 18 guys, 20-plus guys that were in camps from our class. It was crazy. So you don't know what it's like. You show up first as freshmen, and you're all just kind of going against each other. And like the very first rep I ever took at Notre Dame was against, you know, a 275 or 80 pound Bryant Young, and was like, whoa, what is that? We don't got dudes like this in California. I was just leaning on guys, and our league was good, but it just wasn't that talent level. So it took a while to get acclimated. And then this dude, Chris Zort, shows up with a mustache and arms like legs and legs like people. And I'm like, Jesus, where are they getting these dudes from? So it just continued to ramp up. And early on, Andrew, that was tough for me, man. I went home and cried and called my mom, I think, after the third or fourth day of training camp. I'm like, I can't play at this level. These dudes are so big. I'm struggling. Nothing's working. And I think we all just kind of got shell-shocked with the talent level, but cream tends to rise to the top, and we all figured it out on our own timelines. But Vinny Serrato, man, in that class that he put together, I think will go down as one of the best, if not the best ever in Notre Dame history. Just not just the talent wise, but look at the quality of dudes that came out of that, man. I'd put us in the octagon with any other class, not just in Notre Dame, but nationwide in terms of the combination of talent and people.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you mentioned kind of struggling with it at first. How do you feel like you finally kind of found your bearings and got to be the player you became at Notre Dame?
Shoot, I didn't have a choice, man. Joe Moore was my line coach. So every day it was just about getting better and fundamentals and a belief in the basics and repetition over and over and over of the boring, mundane stuff, base block after base block after base block, pass set after pass set after pass set. But for me, my struggle, and I think this is true for a lot more players than are willing to admit it, is confidence. And I was a player that was really talented, but I was a people pleaser, a coach pleaser. Grew up without a dad, and as I've had the benefit of hindsight, being a 52-year-old dude now, looking back, like I wanted that adoration of older men: good block, good adjustment, good decision, good call, good boy. So Joe, I wanted to keep happy as we all did, and stay out of the doghouse. So that took a while, and I started as a true sophomore. I was playing next to some seasoned players in Gene McGuire and Lindsey Knapp. Mirko Jurkovic was the other guard on the other side. All those things really, really helped me, because I'd come up the line of scrimmage, man, I didn't know if the play was going left or right, run or pass. It was moving fast. They'd be like, block 52. Like, oh, okay. And, I'd eventually get there with terrible technique and, figured it out as we went. But I think that was Joe's secret sauce, man. At first, he believed in us, then we believed in his belief, and eventually we believed in ourselves. And when I did that personally, and when we did that collectively, our opponents had problems.
Yeah, definitely. And something my colleague Tim Priester wanted me to talk about, I know you also ended up playing offensive tackle too, and he said you were stellar at both. What do you think kind of allows you to do that? I mean, I know Notre Dame now has some guys, Charles Jagasaw, we've seen do both. Gerby Lambert, they're having do that a little bit right now in camp. What made you and maybe other offensive linemen be able to kind of thrive at both positions, where I know the skill set is a little bit different?
Thrive may be a little hyperbolic. It certainly didn't feel that way. I don't know if many other left tackles could have won the Lombardi in a right-handed stance. It was ridiculous, but I just couldn't feel comfortable, man. I was unanimous All-American as a left guard in the spring before my senior year. Hey, Taylor, we're moving you to left tackle. Have a seat. It was like, that was it. That was the whole conversation. And it's a different animal out there. There's so much more space. The timing of it, the way that the box looks, one position over is completely different. I now have to worry about the slot defender and whether or not he's got safety help as a blitz threat, and just a whole nother set of things. I've got a guard next to me that now I've got to work these combination blocks with this person to my inside that plays the position, but he's doing it totally different. So he's doing it for the first time. I'm doing it for the first time. And it just, there's an acclimation period, man. I did graduate, I promise, of getting used to that. And the analogy I use is, way back in the day, man, I used to be a Microsoft guy, right? And then I switched to a Mac, and I remember how frustrating it was, because the Mac did everything that the Microsoft computer did, but it was in a different place. It was a little different location. The commands then were different. And there was this learning curve, a lot like learning a new language. So you get the basics, but the nuances of it take a while to get efficient and just have it be automatic. So that process takes some time. So I think it's harder going inside to outside than outside in.
That Microsoft and Mac comparison actually makes a lot of sense. I've made the same transition, and you're definitely just like kind of slower with everything you want to do for a period of time. So I think that's a good analogy. So I want to kind of wrap up your Notre Dame career, because I know we only have a little bit of time. But what, I know 93, that was a really great season, maybe didn't work out how you wanted to, but what are maybe some like highlights or things that really stuck out to you about your time actually being on campus? Obviously, you also became a captain too that season, I believe.
Yeah, I was a senior captain with Tim Ruddy, Bryant Young, and Jeff Burris. just incredible people and, you know, among the best leaders that I've ever been with. And we were a senior laden team. Like, we policed things. And I remember prior to that year, Coach Holtz was pretty set on having Ron Paulus be the quarterback. And we were not going to let that happen. Kevin McDougal was our dude. And we were all sitting meeting like, how are we going to mutiny this thing? Like, we got to go in and talk to Coach Holtz, which was like, you know, the holiest of the holies. And like, how do we do it? But like, we were resigned, and thankfully for us, not necessarily for Ron, you know, he got hurt in that last scrimmage. So Kevin had to play and single-handedly beat Michigan that year and helped us, you know, have a chance to win the national championship, and certainly did his part. But I look at that picture behind you, man, of the Snow Bowl. And yeah. I mean, that was on my birthday, my junior year, right? So the 2-point play that happens after that, like, I was talking with Greg Hudson, who was our grad assistant during that time, and we had scored the touchdown right before, and Holtz goes, what do we got for the 2-point play? They got all the answers, like, we just ran it. Then all of a sudden panic ensued, because what we scored on the touchdown was what we were going to score on the 2-point play. So we ended up calling, I don't remember the name of the play call, it was so long ago, but it was a pass to Reggie Brooks, and like, Reggie didn't have the best of hands in the world. It was cold. I got beat right off the snap by Tyoka Jackson, who went on to have a, you know, pretty decent NFL career. So the whole time of mine, I'm like, oh my God, don't let me be the guy. Don't let me be the guy. Don't let me be the guy. Throw it. And he threw it, and like, that sense of relief that came over because I got beat on the snap. When he caught it, the crowd erupted, man. That's a moment I'll never forget. I'll never forget pregame my senior year for senior day before the Boston College game, crying then and crying after the game. Oh, yeah. The highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. But just the bowl games and the, you know, stupid trips to medieval times where they're jousting and you're eating chicken and, you know, guinea hens or whatever the heck they called it. When I leak back about my career, the thing that really stands out is the people and the relationships of that place. And Katie and Mike Schaefer are family now. And that's where I used to go to get away from campus and get, you know, laundry and a hot home-cooked meal and just be Aaron and not feel the pressure and not be judged and just kind of unwind and, you know, go get in the corner and fall in a big heap and start sobbing or crying or just like let the pressure off, man. Oh, no, if people truly understand what it takes to be a high-profile college athlete, and we had it easy by comparison back in the day.
Definitely, and I'm glad you noticed the photo and recognized it right before recorded. I was like, oh, I guess he was in this game, and I didn't even think about it until like right before. And so, yeah, after you wrap up your career, the Green Bay Packers drafted you in the first round, I believe, with the 16th overall pick. You played there for a few years, won Super Bowl 31. What was it like kind of then going to the NFL? And I know you had some injury issues you were kind of also fighting through, but what was that acclimation like and playing for such a good team right away, too?
Yeah, I thought I was going to Tampa, the Rams, fifth or sixth overall, but the NFL knew something I didn't, which is I didn't have the length to play left tackle. I just assumed since they needed an old lineman and probably a tackle, and since I played tackle my senior year, ergo, it would be me, but it wasn't. And thankfully so, because I dropped precipitously on draft day, which sucked at the time, but I fell into a gold mine of the green and gold in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and, you know, had an opportunity to be on the field for two of Brett Favre's three MVP seasons, to watch a Reggie White in the locker room and on the field in his preparation. And, you know, those dudes were born with things that I just didn't have. I had earned the right to be on the field with those guys, but they were special. They were elite. There was a hierarchy. So to be able to come into that organization with Ron Wolf and Mike Holmgren and John Gruden as our wide receivers coach, Andy Reid is our tight ends coach, Steve Mariucci is our quarterbacks coach, Dick Geron, who was later the head coach of the Chicago Bears, was a DB coach. I mean, the coaching tree that came out that was in that building that I was there, and the quality of player, Leroy Butler was a Gold Jacket guy, Reggie Brett, obviously, several dozen, you know, players that are in the Packers Hall of Fame. It was amazing. Now, I didn't start out great with the injury, but I was able to overcome those and finish out strong. Was on IR my first year, played the whole season, got hurt in the first playoff game my second year, stayed healthy the entire year. We go to and win the Super Bowl. I'm not saying that it was because of me, but that's just science. And then the last year, you know, stayed healthy, went to the Super Bowl and lost. And I signed a free agent deal out for the Chargers and, you know, went from Brett Favre to Ryan Leaf and, you know, just had a different experience there. But, man, I got 6 years in. I was the only guy that had ever come back from two ruptured patella tendons at the time. But it was a wild ride and quite a fun one that had a lot of success and some failures along the way, too.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely, I mean, maybe not as long as you wanted, but you obviously fit a lot into to those 6 years. And then I think also what's interesting in doing more research is just, I mean, I feel like the last 25 years or so of your life have been potentially even more interesting, like reading more about you, like kind of as you figured out that transition after football. It sounds like you were teaching in South America, like trying to figure out what was next before ABC eventually called. But what was it like kind of, it sounds like you really kind of wanted to go a philanthropic route, but then also kind of fell into the sports broadcasting thing and then have kind of found a way to do both. What was that transition like for you in kind of discovering that path?
It was dark. It was really dark. I think like a lot of players, we go through an identity crisis when we were done. So in one fell swoop, I lost the thing that I loved, the thing that I was really good at, and the thing that I got paid handsomely for. I call that the elusive sweet spot. And we all make the mistake of feeling better than we've ever felt. And, you know, this elation and this fulfillment and this purpose on a daily basis from the time we start playing sports, boom, and it's gone. So we make the mistake of trying to replace this one thing with the next thing, not realizing just how unique and unicorn-y that one thing is. And I think I made that mistake. And I just tried to fill the vacuum with a lot of wild turkey and late nights. And it turns out that that's not the best recipe for fulfillment or happiness or liver health. So I had to shut it down and hang up my drinking cleats 2.5 decades ago. And then it just kind of became about this process of like, damn, what do I want to do now that I'm all grown up? You know, I had a big house, a fancy car, a couple coffee cans saved, but I was empty inside. So I kind of just ripped it open and went in there and started scrubbing, you know, the infection out and, you know, figured out there were, I didn't know who I was. That was the big thing, I think, is the identity of like, who's Aaron Taylor? Not AT, not 75 or the Super Bowl champ, but like, who's Aaron? I didn't even know. So I went on a walkabout and went to South America and taught English, which was really a way for me to see that part of the country, travel and learn Spanish. I went to Sri Lanka after the tsunami in 2004 and did a bunch of relief work over there. Went back to grad school, got my multi-subject teaching credential because I figured out I love teaching, was patient and kids, and I loved it. But then I got married and we got pregnant right out of the gate. And my wife was like, charity starts at home, go get a job. And that's when television started. So it's been this wild, crazy ride, but what we have in football, and this is, you know, I think for the people that have gone through transition or about to go through transition, regardless of what it is, this is a very common cycle, is when we retire, the first thing we lose is our identity, how we're known to the world, how we're, you know, known to ourselves. The second's an income, right? How we receive value for the value we bring. Those are the two big obvious ones. But below that, we have purpose, what we feel we're put on this planet to do. We have significance, how we know we're different, and then community, being part of something greater than ourselves. So income, identity, purpose, significance, and community are what I call the five pillars of fulfillment. And if we don't figure out a way to replace those or to Frankenstein them together, have some sort of core aspects where that is a piece of what we do on a daily basis, we just simply aren't going to be as fulfilled, I found, as if we have that. So it took me a decade to figure that out. And the way that that looks for me now is during the football season, I got income and identity as a college football analyst for CBS Sports. I've got the Joe Moore Award and Trench Life, our new show that we're, you know, dropping Thursday, August 21st, which is tomorrow from us taping this. And that's all fun, but I've got these 8 months of the off season where I get to be purposeful, significant, do things in the community. And I got to tell you, Andrew, I am more fulfilled now in my life, in my marriage, as an individual, as an employee, as all the different hats I wear, as I ever thought about being in the NFL. So I would strongly encourage people that are listening, that are going through transition or just feel like something's missing, to take a look at those five pillars. and evaluate them and figure out how to add or take away those pieces that are preventing those things, because they really tend to form the basis of a life that is pretty dang good.
No, that's incredible. And I feel like, you know, a lot of the service you've done, I'm sure this is not why you do it, but you get recognized quite a bit for the things you do in the community. I know, for instance, you won the Edward Moose Krauss Distinguished Service Award. You received that at the Blue Gold game this year. So I know that's a lot of that's getting recognized, all the good work you do. And another award that you've mentioned you're involved with, I'm guessing that might be even your shirt, the Joe Moore Award. But that's something I'm really interested in talking about, because I mean, it's only, I believe the first year is 2015. I think it's one of the cooler college football awards, but there's so many out there. I'm kind of curious how, like, and I believe you're a founder or co-founder too. Like, how do you start a college football award and get something off the ground that's, you know, in such a short period of time is celebrated? And I mean, I feel like that trophy's all over social media whenever the next team wins it.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. It's incredible. This whole thing has been this process of embodying the very same principles that we're celebrating, right? Toughness and teamwork. We've had to work our tails off together with limited resources or athletic ability, you know, to use the offensive line analogy, and still find ways to be successful. But I think what's happened is we're living in a time of the selfie and instant results and outcomes versus process. And the Joe Moore Award has kind of become this antidote of sorts to the disease of me. It's a celebration of toughness and teamwork and togetherness and sacrificing effort and ego and comfort for the greater good. Well, shoot, that's not just the basis of good O-lines, but good communities, good countries, you know, good people. So I think we've resonated, especially being the only group or unit award that's out there. We're kind of like the award of the people, man. Like, whether you played O-line or not, I think people appreciate the unsung heroes in all walks of life. So we've just found an incredible way to do that, to celebrate football. And very quickly, I realized it was much bigger than Joe Moore. It was much bigger than me. It was much bigger than football. So we're cognizant of that in all of our communications. Everything we do, we try to bring value, focus on what we can give to the teams, to the units, to the fans versus what we can get out of them. So we're always focused on what we can bring and deliver and offer versus what we can get. And that's a very different approach. But even in a business context, we found that that's opened invisible doors, so to speak. So the part I don't often like to talk about out loud is we've had some divine intervention, man. We've had some hella tailwinds that push this thing forward. I think Joe's up, you know, top smoking cigarettes, rah, rah, and just opening doors for us, because it's been the hardest I've ever worked, and it's been the most effortless process I've ever been a part of at the same time. And I don't know, it's like parenting, right? I'm a parent of this award. It's like the hardest thing you do, but also the most rewarding at the same time. But it's also been effortless. The right person, the right way, at the right time, every single time, doors have opened. And man, like, preserving his legacy is becoming part of my legacy. And I'm aware of that. And I'm feeling emotion as I say that, because I get to be a part of something year round that is bigger than me, but it involves every aspect of me. And just one of the many ways I've outkicked my coverage, man.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think when I first started covering college football in like 2019, I think that was something I didn't realize was so new. Like, it felt so established so quickly and so prominent. And obviously Notre Dame won it in 2017. And kind of transitioning to the team, I know, you know, as a CBS Sports analyst, you don't always get Notre Dame games. I know last year, I believe you had the USC game. Mm-hmm. I know you kind of did a little thing where you slapped the sign outside of the studio and stuff like that to kind of play it up. But what's it been like for you, you know, now, I mean, several coaches removed from Lou Holtz, to kind of still engage with the team, knowing that it's, you know, I know when you do cover them, you have to be objective, but you also seen some of the success they had last year under Marcus Freeman.
It's a great point. Football's a people game. So when you go back, you want to see the people that were there. And when staffs turn over and people age, you know, it changes. So being on the outside looking in and not being able to get back except for a spring game, maybe flying back to interview one of the coaches for, you know, 24 hours max, flying in and flying out, I've largely been removed. So this year was the first year that I rooted and cheered and threw remote controls at the TV like a fan for a football team on the Irish in 30 years. And it was because it reminded me of us. This team last year and what Marcus has built and is building and is built is gritty and talented with good people, and corners weren't cut, and it's incredible. And we all have bought in, and I think there's a familiarity to what it is he's done that feels really good. It's a modern version and a hat tip to the old school era, and NIL has certainly helped that. It's allowed us to, you know, fight fire with fire, so to speak, in ways that we couldn't do before. Good quality players that are good people that are going to do the right things in the classroom have always existed, but they've had a lot of other options and been incentivized to maybe go other places. And now it's a much fairer fight, and those players love him. And, you know, I sat down with him. I know we've only got a couple minutes left here, but I sat down with him before that USC game. And in my preparation for that interview, I saw his speech when, you know, he was named the head coach, and he said, "I'm ready to take Notre Dame, you know, back to the championship caliber program, you know, it is or whatever." And I butchered that. But I asked him that question. I said, "Hey, when you took over, you said you're ready to take Notre Dame back to the promised land." I said, "Were you as ready as you thought?" And he laughed and laughed and laughed because the answer was obviously no. And then we got into the conversation of how he's had to learn, how he's had to adapt, and how, quite frankly, there were some ways that he wasn't ready that has shown up in an inexplicable loss at Northern Illinois. But just like in life, man, sometimes the worst things that happen to you end up being the best things that happen to you. And there is no doubt that that really springboarded the season of placing Notre Dame in the national championship game with a legit shot to win against a much more talented team, in my opinion, than Ohio State to win in the second half. Like, it was incredible. Like, there was no water left to squeeze from the talent and the mindset out of that team. And I think it's a big reason why fans should be really excited to what I'm predicting is going to be an undefeated season and another appearance in the national championship game.
Yeah, definitely. And to your point, like, just even with all the injuries they had by the time they got to Ohio State too, to, as you mentioned, squeeze everything out of it, like to get that far and beat some of the teams they did just to get there. But I know you have a hard stop coming up, so I want to be respectful of that. So thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today.
Oh, you're welcome, Andrew. I love what you guys do. Tell Tim P. I said what's up, and I know this was shorter than we wanted, so maybe we'll just have a chance to do again and do a part two or something.
That'd be great. I feel like I have plenty more questions I could ask you.
We didn't even get into World's Strongest Man in the Caveman Olympics. I got so many stories from doing that. I'd love to come on and tell them.
We'll definitely have to do a part two then. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Go Irish!